Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, you're going to hear me reunite with an old college friend who I haven't spoken to in 3 decades. And we'll be talking about resiliency, goals, meditation, and what it's like to be a Buddhist monk. You see, back when I was an undergraduate at Rutgers College, my friends and I would talk about philosophy, Zen, and all those lofty topics that fill the heads of college students with too much time on their hands. And after college, my friend Mike went off, became a doctor in New Jersey. My friend Sandy teaches philosophy in Chicago. I run a software company in the Philadelphia area. And Keith? Well, we lost track of Keith for a long time. And it turns out, that's because Keith went off to India and other places to study martial arts, Buddhism, and he eventually became a Buddhist monk. You don't see that every day. Today, he's the abbot of the Kurinji Rinzai Zen Monastery near Madison, Wisconsin, which he actually built that monastery. He founded that monastery himself. And he's also the author of 2 books, The Rinzai Zen Way, A Guide to Practice, and Hidden Zen, Practices for Sudden Awakening and Embodied Realization. He also provides amazing instruction and behind-the-scenes videos on the Kurinji Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/Kurinji, K-O-R-I-N-J-I. Oh, and Keith isn't Keith anymore. He now has a Dharma name. I hope you enjoy my conversation with the abbot of Kurinji and my dear friend, Mado Moore.
My God, 30 years, don't talk to me. You look exactly the same.
I can't tell you how good it is to talk to you. I've just been so looking forward to this. This is just amazing.
Yeah, me too. And honestly, I'm in touch with almost no one from those days. So I'm just really geeked to connect with somebody.
You're wearing, for, you know, people are going to be listening to this. They can't see. You've got a good headset on and everything else. You must be doing a lot of podcasts. Like, you're clearly a pro at doing these Zoom calls.
Oh, God. No, not at all, actually. What we've actually been doing a lot of that has helped fund Kurinji, this monastery where I'm sitting, is our Patreon page where we're doing video instruction. So I'm doing quite a bit of that kind of stuff and video editing and so on. But this is new. Just got this headset.
It's great.
Because I've gotten requested to do interviews for different podcasts and things. And, you know, I'm in rural Wisconsin, so the satellite internet here is sometimes a little dicey. So, you know, anything that keeps the sound quality as good as possible, that's what this is for.
That's great. Before we go any further, I have to thank you again because you, gosh, this is almost a year ago now. You met with my daughter, Natalie, who is a student in college at Fordham in New York. And she reached out to you to interview you for her Buddhism class. It was just very gracious of you to do that. It meant a lot to her, meant a lot to me, of course. And she clearly got an A in that class. And the teacher said, in all the years he's taught that class, no student ever went out and spoke to a monk before.
Fantastic. Well, Natalie's amazing. It was really a pleasure. And it was just fun to see that some of your same qualities displayed.
Right, I won't ask what those are.
All the good ones, you know, but that was before even you and I got to talk. So it was kind of interesting to talk to her first.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's taken us a while to get this. Okay, Mado, I know I've listened to a lot of your other interviews, and a standard obvious first question, which I'm not exactly going to ask. People are like, okay, how does this young man from New Jersey become a Buddhist monk? You know, how the heck does that happen? And I'm not going to ask that question. You talk about, you know, being sort of a deep thinking, feeling kid who then is in religious studies at Rutgers, goes over to India, trains and works with some eminent scholars and teachers who you didn't even realize what was going on at the time. You ride this wave of interest in Buddhism, but also martial arts. Takes you to Chicago with some teachers. Next thing you know, you're an ordained Rinzai Zen monk, okay? I know I didn't do it quite exact, but it's close. But here's the real question. To me, that all makes sense. What I'm so curious about is, like, societal expectations and fear. So many people here in the West, right, in the United States, think about our friends at Rutgers. They became lawyers because they were kind of told by their parents or doctors, oh, you know, parents are doctors, you should be a doctor. Or go be a business person. It's, you make a lot of money, whatever it is. And not too many people have the thought like, oh, I'm going to grow up someday and become a Buddhist monk. And even if you had come back after 30 years and said, oh, I'm a Catholic priest. Some people be like, huh, didn't see that coming. Didn't know he was so religious. But Buddhist monk, for those of us here in the States, like, that's like, whoa, that's really unusual. Did you face like this pressure at any point on this very unconventional path you took after Rutgers?
No, not at all. And, you know, speaking about parents, I think I was really fortunate. I know I was really fortunate that they were not parents who ever pressured me in any direction. I mean, I think the only pressure I ever got from them was to go to Rutgers because I had a partial scholarship there.
And good reason.
My brother was in Columbia, so I wasn't going to go to, you know, like Swarthmore or something. And I'm actually grateful for Rutgers because of tremendous opportunities there, as you know. But I never had any pressure from anyone except to what was stated, just to pursue whatever makes you happy. So I always felt that freedom. And it's, in some sense, it's a naivete. I never gave any consideration to financial realities or to going to college for vocation. I had the privilege not to have to worry about that in a sense. But then I got out of college and, you know, as you said, I rode this wave. Doors just opened. I met teachers. I always had something to do. I always had a roof over my head. I always had food. I don't have much more beyond that, but I feel tremendously satisfied with my life. Yeah, what a gift that I didn't feel that pressure because of my upbringing, because of the situation in which I was raised. You know, I didn't want for anything, but also because I was raised by people that didn't have an interest in trying to drive me in any particular direction. So I was free to go where my heart led me.
And I mean, similar to the expectation, I'm curious about the fear or lack of fear part, meaning, you know, again, we literally haven't spoken in 30-ish years, right? And yet, I mean, if I just think about the last couple of weeks, my friends, people who are close to me, family members, so many of them will say things like they watch the stock market every day. The stock market crashes this week or something. They'll say, oh my gosh, my retirement, my 401k is down so much. I'm going to have to work an extra 6 months before I retire. Or they get in a bad mood when they see the stock market go down with this retirement money. I know a lot of people, breaks my heart, who will say, I hate my job. I really want to do X, be an artist, be a teacher, whatever, but they make no money and I don't want to be a homeless person when I turn 65 and I'm retired. Right. I'm assuming Karenji doesn't have a very good 401k plan for you.
That's very, very perceptive of you. we could start with a reasonable stipend. You know, congruent with what a average clergy should make. But, we're a relatively new organization, too. So, and again, those are valid fears. I would like not to be homeless when I'm 65, too, if I make it that long. But for whatever reason, I've just never lived with those concerns. In the sense, it's very freeing to not worry about those things. But there are real realities. If I were to get very sick, for example, right now, how are we going to deal with that? That's a real question. So I would never say that someone who has those kinds of valid fears, I would never say they're invalid, right? But for whatever reason, maybe it's naivete, maybe it's a kind of charming yet somewhat stupid innocence. Again, naivete. They're not things I've worried about, but I'm also satisfied with little. I don't have dependents. I don't have children. I'm not currently married. That alone is a very freeing thing, not to have the responsibility to care for others. So that's a choice I made. Those are choices I made, and I lost some things because of that too. You know, I don't have children. I think that might have been a wonderful thing to do. But here I am, and I'm doing what my passion is, and I'm following what I feel like is my life path. I wouldn't trade that for anything. And, you know, from a young age, my biggest priority was always what I said to myself. I don't want to be at the end of my life and feel like I didn't spend it in the most profoundly valuable way. I didn't follow my path. So for better or worse, I was a person I couldn't do otherwise. Pay a price for that, but yeah, the rewards are there too. Yeah,
absolutely. Also, and this is maybe going to only be relevant to people listening to this podcast who were our friends from Rutgers, who knew you from before. I want to talk about like physicality in Buddhism, and I want to get at it by starting here. So I'm going to get this story wrong. I don't remember where I heard it, so I know I'm going to get it wrong. But like, I think there's a story about how maybe it was the Dalai Lama when he was a young boy, rushed out of the room and through a door in such a careless manner that his teacher at the time made him come back and scolded him and made him do it again very mindfully. And apparently these days people will travel thousands of miles just to watch how the Dalai Lama opens a door, touches the doorknob. And I will say, so I stalked you online for a long time, right before I found you. And the way I first found you was by searching with your last name and Aikido. And I found you some YouTube videos of you. I think you were already not Keith, you were Mado. And so I'm like, is this the same person that I knew from 30 years ago? And I'm watching. And I could see the resemblance, and you have very piercing blue eyes, but it wasn't so close. I couldn't tell. Like, and then I'm going to apologize about the words I used in my mind. They're going to sound horrible. I remember looking at the video of you and saying, it looks like Keith, but he's acting like a monk. And I used the word acting, and I didn't mean in a negative way. What I meant was, like, you moved differently. You do move differently now. So what is it, whether someone's traveling to watch the Dalai Lama open a door a certain way, or when me not seeing you for decades and I'm watching you on video just doing your thing, but I can see a difference. What is it that I'm seeing?
Yeah. Okay. And again, I know a lot of your listeners might not necessarily be interested in Buddhism per se, but so let me say it in the most kind of general way, kind of the approach to spirituality, which comes out from some of these traditions like Buddhism, is what we call an embodied approach, which is to say we recognize that we can use the body and the senses in particular ways to affect how the mind functions. And there's obviously a lot of brain science behind this, which is confirming those 3,000-year-old insights now. So what that means is the so-called spiritual path or spiritual training in a tradition like Buddhism, it's not a primarily psychological activity or a primarily intellectual or conceptual activity. It's something where you do encompass and work with the posture, the breathing, the way the energetics of the body function, the way we even use our eyes, whether we use peripheral vision versus foveal vision, has an effect on the brain activity. So because of many years of that kind of training, someone who's really deeply engaged in it should move or should appear a little different. I'm not saying better or worse, but there's something about the way they're using their frame and the way that they're in their skin, they're present in their body, rather than having a real marked sort of mind-body split, which is obviously common enough for folks. So if you see something different, if you sense that, I think that's a good thing. And I didn't know the Dalai Lama story. That's a good one.
I'll see if I made up that story. I have to hunt it down.
You know, Kevin, just for you on our Patreon page, one of my next videos now, I'm going to do how to open a door in the Zen manner.
So, well,
you got me thinking now.
Okay, so you joke about that. And, you know, I'm doing this dance of Zen and non-Zen, you know, topics. But I think everyone would find some of this interesting. In one of your Patreon page videos, you talk about movement and space being just right. And at first I didn't get it. And then you use the example of shaking someone's hand, and you could go overreach and too vigorous or too far back and too soft. And we all instinctively know the right movement. Again, I don't have the words for it, but I'm like, oh, I get that. And so I'm assuming opening the door, if you're doing it mindfully, has a similar approach.
Oh, yeah, it's a joke, but I actually will do that video. We can definitely do that. You know, again, we just have to recognize, because we're physical creatures, we're embodied creatures, that the way we habitually use our bodies can affect how happy we are. They can affect how we experience things. You know the classic image of the person who's so engrossed in spinning thoughts, staring at their phone as they walk down the sidewalk. They don't even know where they are in space, and they're not actually living in the world. They're living inside their head, and it's not a pleasant place to be spinning like that constantly. So we can learn how to use the body and the senses in a way that contributes to our happiness. So something like opening a door, it's so simple, but you can open a door by walking up to it and reaching out with just your arm in a stiff manner, yanking the door open, and you've just added tension to your body. You're probably thinking about something else as you're doing it. You're not relating to the living quality of the world around you, even if it's just door. And if you do it that way with a door, you're probably doing it that way when you shake someone's hand. You're probably doing that in relationship. You're probably doing it in all aspects of your life, with your work, with everything. Or we can approach the door and we can feel what's the right distance, the right amount of strength. How do I use my whole body to open the door? And the point is, when I do it that way, I experience differently. I feel more calm. I feel more open. I can feel the wood of the door. I can appreciate the craftsmanship of the door. I'm present in that space. There's just a whole satisfying quality to the simple interaction of, you know, opening a door. If we can learn how to do it in the simple physical activities, that's a path of training I was talking about. Then when we talk to someone, for example, we can be present with them the same way. Whatever work we're doing, even typing on my laptop, I can do that in a way which adds tension and stress to my body and my mind, or I can do it in a way which I'm still connected to the room around me. There's a joyfulness to just the very movement, the physical activity, even of typing, if we approach it a particular way. So, you know, life is full of those kind of small, seemingly insignificant activities, but that's what life is. We're opening doors, we're walking, we're all these things we have to do every day. So how can we do them in a way which supports our clarity and our happiness and releases tension rather than adds tension and keeps us present rather than keeps us spinning in our minds? We can say that this is Buddhist training or Zen training, but I think this is just an effective use of the human existence.
That's great. Now, you are a monk in the Rinzai Zen tradition, and again, for people unfamiliar, there isn't just one Buddhism, just like there's, you know, here in the West, you know, Catholicism, Protestantism, even within Protestantism, there's branches, right?
Yes.
Rinzai Zen, the Zen of samurais, true or false?
A little of both. So it's when Zen came to Japan from China, so Zen came from India to China and then all of East Asia to Japan. It happened to arrive right at the time that the samurai class had taken over the government, so 13th, 14th century. So what you had was these rough, uncultured warriors, and you had Chinese Zen monks. They met each other, and somehow they recognized they had some commonalities in the way they were training their bodies and training to be present and to be energetic and so on. Of course, with very different motivations for doing so. But for that reason, I guess the samurai, so-called samurai culture, warrior culture, which influenced Japan so deeply, has a thread of Zen in it, the Zen of view or the Zen approach to using the body and the senses. That being said, if you go to any bookstore, you know, go on Amazon and search for Zen, whatever, you'll find a bunch of martial arts and samurai books and statements like Zen was the religion of the samurai and the samurai were all enlightened Zen. That's kind of a load of crap. The religious or spiritual, you know, situation in Japan over the century is much more complex than that. But, you know, Zen warrior culture in Japan, yes, somewhat influenced by that. The better parts, the more noble parts of it, yes, I would say so.
And you, in one of the other interviews that I listened in preparation for this, you make this point that there's a lot of misconceptions about what it's like to live in a monastery or to practice in a monastery, and that people seem to think it's like going to a day spa or something very relaxing. And I will also share, before getting your reaction and explanation on this, a story you don't know. You'll see where this is going, but maybe our listeners will find some humor in it. Back in college with Mike and Sandy, I went to a weekend retreat at the Zen Mountain Center in the Catskills in New York State. And I think we, you know, probably read one Alan Watts book or something, right? And thinking this is going to be this very relaxing, meditative, calm experience. And I can remember, and looking back at myself, like, it's almost with shame and like, what a fool, you know, I was back then. And we arrive, and the first thing, we're walking up their long, beautiful grounds, and we're walking up their long driveway, and this man in robes and shaved head is coming our way. Oh, very good. We see our first monk today. You know, this is very nice. And he says, of course, in like a New York accent, "Good morning, guys. I'm just going to get the New York Times. I just love reading the paper every day." And of course, I get immediately judgy, like, is that monk like to be so attached to the New York Times? You know, like, this is really stupid. And then the story, though, so I'm thinking it's all about this relaxing thing. Well, we go the morning into the meditation, and I don't know how many people are there, 20, 30, and my memory's probably, you know, blowing this up. Everybody's in robes. They give us robes. We're in robes. No instruction, though. Like, we don't really know what's going on. We're just kind of following people as they're doing things. And there's no other visitors. It's just me, Sandy, and Mike in the monastery. So we sit down, they're cross-legged, I'm full lotus, and we start meditating. And it's so quiet. Like, you're in the mountains, and it's quiet. And then to my right, I hear Sandy rustling. His robes are rustling as he's moving. He does that a little bit. And then the monk in the front says, silence. One word, silence. Uh-oh. There's silence for less than a minute, and Sandy starts rustling again. And you hear the robes moving around. The monk booms out, silence! He screams. And then someone else, you know, there jumps up, runs over, grabs Sandy up and takes him out. You know, I figure he's going to get his beating down in the basement or something. So now I'm sitting there terrified, not calm at all. Thoughts running wild, like, oh my gosh, what are we doing? We're wrecking this and we're going to get thrown out and poor Sandy, all this stuff. So we're sitting for about, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes. And during that period of time, my right leg falls asleep. And I am not going to move a centimeter. I am not going to get beat by the monks, right? So the time period ends. I have no feeling in my leg. So it's the sort of that you wake up in the middle of the night and you slept on your arm or whatever. No feeling. We stand up. Thank goodness this is over. You know, that was my leg, no feeling. And then to my surprise, everybody turns and starts jogging around. I think Kinshin or something. I don't know.
Kinhin. Yeah.
So I did not expect that. So now I'm hobbling around with like one leg hopping on this thing. It was Mike will laugh at this story. And I was so freaked out by like, I don't know what's going on. I'm so embarrassed and everything else. They have this beautiful giant Buddha statue. I left. I walked across to the pond and until nightfall, I sat next to that Buddha. I wouldn't go back in. I was just so inside myself and freaked out by that. And so I ended up with a fast that day as well. And you say that people have this misconception of like, oh, go to the, you know, the Buddhist monastery. It's going to be so relaxing. And you used the word, you said it's almost more like a boot camp. What the heck do you mean by that? What did I get wrong? And what is it in reality?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that even after 30 years, the image of you, Sandy, and Mike sitting there in robes just makes me laugh.
It's hilarious. Oh, yeah. It's a good
one. I wish I could have seen that. What a good one. I mean, I don't know if you got something wrong, but a retreat like that. So you were doing seated meditation, what we call Zazen in Japanese. And that's something that requires a little bit of foundation of practice before you would jump into a retreat situation. It's very normal for someone like Sandy to feel a little uncomfortable sitting still like that for a period of time and to start to get fidgety and to move. Of course, he's a philosopher too, so he's going to fidget even more. Sandy, that one's for you. But it would have been more ideal to have some instruction to know what to expect, to gradually work up to a retreat situation like that. And that's how we do things here. But that is the discipline, that is the practice that makes it somewhat boot camp-like is, it's not an escape. It's a practice of being uncompromisingly present with everything that's going on in your mind and your body. And if that happens to be a little bit of pain or some fidgety quality or your foot falls asleep, that's what you're sitting with because you're training yourself to attend to reality or to attend to the moment by moment of what's actually happening rather than going off spinning in your head someplace. So in that sense, even those difficult situations, we use them. We learn how to use them. That's what can make the training seem difficult. We're not seeking something that's pleasurable. I mean, that's normal people. They seek the pleasurable and they avoid anything that's uncomfortable. You know, even if you're sitting watching a movie, you have an itch, you're going to scratch it without even thinking. We train ourselves differently. We just remain present with those sensations, pleasant or unpleasant. We remain present with them. And we train ourselves to take it, to be present with it. So it's a path to become immensely strong and resilient and accepting. And that's a great thing for life. One of my Zen masters said that Zen training is not for the times of life that are easy. It's for the times of life that are not easy. You know, if I'm someday on my deathbed in tremendous pain, I want to be clear. I want to be present with that. I don't want to, I want to die well, you know, to take it to the extreme example. So that's the part that can seem difficult to folks. If they have an idea, again, a spirituality is a kind of escapism. You know, even the word meditation, people think, oh, I'm going to lie on the ground and someone's going to talk about, you know, now imagine you're on a beach in the Bermuda or something like that. It's not like that. Meditation is to see what's actually going on in your own mind and body and to not run away from it. So welcome to you. That's the experience we have, those first times of going to a retreat like that, sitting there with yourself. Welcome to you. Whatever you brought in your body and mind, that's what you're going to be sitting in front of, like a mirror. That's the part that can seem like boot camp. It's not that it's meant to be difficult, but I think that is difficult for normal people.
And what you describe with this intense Zazen meditation seems totally different than what seems increasingly popular, which is, let me get the Calm meditation app or one of these. There's several of them now. Let me do my 5-minute timer. Let me sit for five minutes. So what are your thoughts? Is that just, that's just a different thing and it's just a different thing, or is that harmful to what we should be striving for, or is it a good door into something deeper? What are your thoughts about those apps and these kind of like 5-minute a day things?
Well, I think they're fine. Anything that gives people benefit, I have no problem with. I mean, for people to understand, hey, I can self-regulate. I can release my tension a little bit. I can, if I start to breathe a certain way for 5 minutes, I feel better. Who would deny that to anyone? I think that's wonderful. It's not the profound path of meditation as we talk about in something like Zen. But if it's a door to that, fine. Even if it's not a door to it, like I said, if it helps the person's life, wonderful. No problem at all.
The other thing I'm curious about, your experience living in a monastery and just even the Zen approach to objects of say, comfort. And again, this might have been some time ago, social media, you posted, and again, I'm going to get this wrong, but it made me chuckle. It's sort of like, I'm giving myself the luxury of turning in my 1-inch mattress or a 2-inch mattress or something, kind of still very like, okay, I'm glad I don't have that 2-inch mattress. And so how do you think about, like, I know you don't have TV in the monastery, but do you read books of fiction or books for enjoyment? Like, how do you think about comforts and entertainment?
Yeah, and, you know, there's a rhythm in the monastery, too. We have three and a half month periods of kind of intensive training where we deny ourselves those things as part of the discipline. But there is free time, there is enjoyment. There's also enjoyment in simple things, you know, even just going for a walk in the woods or, today someone donated a container of ice cream, which I haven't had in months. Let's have some ice cream. Tastes so good, right? So you really appreciate the simple things. But it's funny you mentioned the bed. For years, I slept on a futon on the floor, but I actually just posted in social media last night. A friend of mine gave me an old Victorian chair, and I put it in my room here, and I took a photo of it. It looks really incongruous here, and I realized this is like the only chair we have in the whole place, but I love this chair. I'm sitting in this chair constantly now. So there's an age to do intensive kind of practice where you really push it and see what you can do without, and I did that. But now I'm 53, so I think it's time to have a softer bed and a nice chair.
Very nice. Very nice. I want to shift and talk about, and this is maybe going to be a little bit more on point for some of our listeners. I want to talk about resilience. And obviously, suffering has been around forever. It didn't start in the year 2020. And it's funny, I think a lot of people forget that even before 2020 came around, there was a lot in the media about rising rates of anxiety, of people going on anti-depression medications, opioid addiction going up, and an increase in mindfulness. And then 2020 hits, the pandemic hits, and then everyone's talking about how hard the year is, how hard life is, how stressed out everybody is. What was really your experience through 2020? I mean, I would assume you don't react to things the way most people do, and yet you have to interact with people who don't have the training or the realization that you have.
You know, I'm not something special, so I struggled with the year, same as anyone. You know, suffering has always existed, yeah, that's true, but also we're living in a modern lifestyle that is uniquely not matching the way our bodies and minds evolved to function. I mean, we evolved to be hunter-gatherers in small social units and to have a certain kind of lifestyle and schedule. And we've thrown that to the winds. Even our social structures, you know, as it often commented, you don't even know your next-door neighbors quite often, right? We, we were already set up to feel a little cut off. Then the pandemic hit, and it just exacerbated and revealed those things so much more strongly. So I struggle with it too. You know, this kind of environment, I'm in rural Wisconsin, can feel very isolated. But what I am grateful for, again, is that I could prevent myself from spinning off into the depths of that, I think, because of my training. Something as simple as learning to breathe differently when I feel the anxiety or the depression start to come up, to remember that, oh, yeah, but I know how to breathe in a way that changes that very quickly, because we have that kind of ancient technology or ancient understanding how to use the body to change the mind. So I don't want to say that anyone should feel bad for losing it this past year. But I also want them to feel, I would want them to feel empowered or to understand, hey, there's things you can do. And if it is like a meditation app, like you mentioned, great. If it's something like Zen, the things we can teach, great. But there's no one who doesn't have the tools or some tools they can use to improve that experience. And at the end of the day, let's also recognize, yeah, this is human life. There's always something coming. This disaster will blow over, and then the next one will come, because there's always something like that. And that's been the nature of our existence for hundreds of thousands of years. But the more we can reconnect with each other, you know, great that social media and things like Zoom have been present for us to at least keep the connections with each other even tenuously. The more we can reconnect with other human beings, I think the easier it's going to be. No matter what disaster comes down the path, we have to do it together. That's how we are hardwired. So could be that this pandemic has reminded people that, hey, relationships are kind of important. I really do need other people. What happens when they get taken away from me like this?
Right.
Let's take it positively. That's a great result. I hope we can capitalize on that.
I've heard, I don't know if this is true, that in Japan, there are some companies, businesses, big businesses, who will send their executives to like retreats at Buddhist monasteries. Have you heard that? And what are they getting? What are the executives, what are their leaders getting from that?
Well, there may be a little bit of a hazing culture in Japanese culture, as you know. you must be forged. Forged means you get hammered, and hammering makes you stronger. And, you know, there's a Japanese word, shugyo, which means basically like forging, and that's the process of self-development. It involves fire and hammering. It's never easy. That's the idea. But team building certainly is a big emphasis in that kind of thing. Yeah, there are businesses that send groups of employees to Zen monasteries to do kind of retreats, sort of like what you went to.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the same experiences and the same difficulties and the same realizations about, you know, how hard it is just to sit still and be quiet with oneself. But they really stress the aspect of going through it as a group. That employee group is going through it as a cadre and forging their relationships of support with one another. That's a tremendous aspect of monastic practice, I think, that we could stress too. A lot of folks, I think, view it as, or they imagine it as kind of like a hermit-like practice. No, the human relationships within the monastery, the way that you learn to support one another, even in silence, so crucial. Otherwise, you would never make it. So I guess that's what the companies may value when they send employees to that kind of thing. Those people may come out from that crucible or that forging, even for just a few days, more tightly knit and more supportive of each other. I think that's the really crucial part.
And I've heard this is almost become a joke in Silicon Valley tech culture about, you know, these billionaire founder CEOs. Jack Dorsey of Twitter comes to mind, who like once a year will go away. And I don't know anything about this, like a 10-day Vipassana silent meditation retreat. What is all that about? And what are people seeking to get out of that experience?
Yeah, you know, Steve Jobs, of course, was always mentioned in that regard too, connection to Zen. You know, I can't speak for the individuals, obviously, but I guess in the worlds which they inhabit with the responsibilities they have, you have to take some time for yourself to remember why you're alive in a more basic level. All of the accomplishment and all of the work and all of the success and failure and living in that world of success and failure, but at some point, if the person doesn't have some way to revisit the core question of, why am I doing this? Aside from the accomplishments.
Sure.
Why am I alive? What's my motivation for doing this? You know, maybe someone comes away from a retreat like that remembering, hey, you know, Yeah, it's great to be successful. Success for its own sake is fantastic, but is this helping people? Do I have a more compassionate or humanistic motivation? Maybe they could touch the core of that again.
This 10-day silent retreat, is this a Zen practice?
No, we do have that kind of silent retreat. The 10-day one you're talking about is it's a related Buddhist tradition, but it's okay. Very similar training to what we do. Yeah, yeah. It's pretty intensive. You're there with yourself. And welcome to you.
You'll probably chuckle, but the question is serious. Would you ever consider, as a way of sustaining Kurinji, doing these executive retreats?
Oh, sure. We can forge anyone. Well, but again, someone like that who comes in, I'm not going to treat them the same as like a novice monk. I understand that they are there to get something useful that they could take back into their work, into their life. So we have done things like that. We certainly can do things like that.
Yeah, that's interesting as another tool in these times. Now, this is a real selfish question. I want to ask you, you're going to be like, why is he asking all these weird questions? I want to ask you about goal setting, goals. And again, the setup on this, for a long time, I was a big believer in goal setting. And in fact, I have a fully written, but I've never published a book on goal setting, how to set goals. And for Rutgers days to about age 40, setting traditional specific goals was very powerful. And often I would achieve what the goal was about. And then I had literally in one day a change of mind about goals. And it's why I've never published the book, because I'm struggling with it. What I realized was that While I had the goal and goals got me whatever it was I wanted, all the time that I had a goal, the goal also had me. And I realized that when I look back now, the why behind the goal wasn't always for healthy reasons. And if I had a goal, and I'm just making this up, but like it's not too far off, like if my goal was about money or business, and I didn't have goals in other areas, well, I was doing great at money and business, not so much in my personal relationships, not so much in my health. Or if my goal is health, lose some weight, run 10K, whatever it is, that's great. But all of a sudden my business and relationships, it's funny how relationships were often the not the goal thing. So so here I am. I had sort of this awakening, you know, at age 40, and now it's 13 years later. And I'm much more of the mind, like it's, so I recognize goal setting, it's almost like it's dangerous. Like it's powerful, but it's dangerous. And I try now these days to be more about habits and systems and less about goals. And I'm guessing now, but when I think about being a Buddhist, being a monk, I would say, well, of course, you're not going to be attached to something like a goal. And yet, wasn't it a goal for you to create and build Kurinji? Wasn't it a goal to write your first book and then your second book? How do you think about goals?
Goals can be addictive, right? You know, the setting of the goal and the process of achieving it, and then the moment of achieving it and the pleasure centers in the brain light up. You know, where goal setting becomes, you know, like the horse with the blinders on and causes you to close yourself off to or to exclude other possibilities or other things that require attention, like relationships, where we all know about that. That's where I think it's not the most useful thing. But I guess what came to my mind immediately as you were saying that is that I never thought of myself as someone who set goals. I thought of myself as someone who set directions. And I don't know if the difference in those two could be clear, but I have to not lose track of my actual motivation or aspiration. What's the direction of my life? And within that, there are goals. But I think a direction is a more broad kind of movement forward that could at any moment pick up a goal or even set it down if it's realized, hey, that goal's actually not so useful for the direction I want to go. You know, in our Way of Zen training, you've read my book, so we talk about how to use the eyes, right? Some people use eyes in a very focused way, foveal vision all the time. Some people, they could learn to use a peripheral vision, which gives you more knowledge and expansive view of what's going on around you. And then within that, you can focus on individual things. That's kind of a nice metaphor for it, I guess. focusing on direction rather than an individual goal, or goals as building blocks of a general direction, to not lose sight of that. Does that make sense?
It makes great sense. I hadn't thought about, you know, linking it back to sort of the use of vision. I'm going to press you just a little bit more on this, only because I'm so, again, it's selfish about goals.
Yeah.
So I know you're thinking about your third book right now, right? Is it like, oh, I want to continue to write and share in this way, and so I will be doing that at some point this year? Or is it like, I'm going to finish my third book in the year 2021?
No, it's not the latter. It's not the latter. And again, I tend to function at some place that is not always, you know, the obvious surface level conceptual thought place. So I'm not actually thinking, what's my book going to be? I'm sort of waiting for it to come to me. Something's bubbling in there. And when that becomes clear, I'll start writing it. But I don't have in my mind, oh, I have to do another book this year, or even that I have to do another book. But I feel like there's something else in there. So right now I'm waiting for it to bubble up. And when it does, if I feel like, again, it matches with the general direction of what I'd like to accomplish, then I'll do it.
And this is another selfish question, just sort of writer to writer. What's your writing process like? Like, do you have any rituals or special places or tricks to get those words flowing?
A lot of coffee.
So monks do drink coffee.
Oh, hell yeah. God, you need it here. We get up early and go to bed late, so you need coffee. Again, I guess my process is sort of intuitive somehow. It just bubbles up. I tend to write out completely from beginning to end what could potentially be the finished work. Mm-hmm. I don't do a lot of outlining. I don't do a lot of thought, really. I just kind of, it just comes out. And then after that, there's the endless editing and re-editing and so on and so on. But the same as at Rutgers, you know, I would write all my papers the night before from beginning to end. And so somehow I did okay. So I guess that's an ability that I had from the beginning.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
It's not structured. It's not structured. It's more intuitive for me, I guess.
That's great. Mato, I want to shift to the books now for people who we've hooked in this far, and I'm sure there's going to be many people in the audience who are Zen practitioners anyway. And so I want to touch on both of your books. I'm going to be sensitive to your time. And in the pre-recording, the introduction that I'll do separate, like people will know your background and their first book, The Rinzai Zen Way, A Guide to Practice. I found two things immediately changed my practice of meditation. Like, I was just shocked that I hadn't heard them before, from some other book or something. And so the first, you know, you have this phrase, you say in Zazen, you don't count your breaths, you breathe the count. You don't count your breaths, you breathe the count. So for people who have a basic understanding of Zen meditation, but maybe are getting that part wrong, can you describe that for us?
Sure. So that's one of the basic or foundational meditation methods we use, so-called breath counting, although it's not easy, even though we call it basic. We have to understand that meditation is a practice to unify so-called mind and body, or mind, body, and breath. Breath is sort of the thread which helps us to unify them. We want to experience things in a less divisive or dualistic manner. You know, our usual way of seeing things is, I'm here, the universe is over there. And some of those things I like, some of those things I don't like. You know, that's how we exist. We call this a dualistic way of viewing or seeing. Meditation is to help us start to make that a little more permeable and to transform that. So what that means is, if we're practicing in a dualistic manner, we're not going to get there. If I set up my breath as a mental object that I here am counting, subject-object dualism is inherently in that. That's not the real meditation. The real meditation is to, I try to, again, approach it with language insufficiently maybe, but rather than count the breath, you breathe the count. Means you're not counting something, but you have to become that count. With every exhalation, you're mentally counting one, two, and so on. You're trying as much as you can to unify in your experience this thing I call a body, this thing I call my mind, my breath. Also, the environment, even the division between so-called internal, external, inner world and environment, will start to drop away if we practice. So I guess to sum it up, we could say meditation in that sense is a process of how to become one with. How do I become one with my body, one with my mind, one with the environment, means also, how do I become one with my work? How do I become one with the person that I'm talking to? How do I become one with my partner in relationship? If I'm always in a subtle way viewing my work, my partner, my relationship, my environment as separate from me, in Buddhism, that's the fundamental human delusion. That's the source of our angst. So meditation could be a way to start to bridge that or break down those barriers of separateness, which means also we should never feel alone. We feel more open, more happy, more connected to our environment, to the people. Something as simple as counting your breath or breathing the count, becoming one with the count and the breath. That difference is really crucial. Hard to explain, hard to get across, right? But I hope that that kind of change in the language could help someone who's a meditator to recognize, something different now.
The other thing I'm hoping you can explain for everyone listening as well, you know, I think very often when I would meditate, even if I was counting breaths, it would be in a relaxed way. I'm counting my breaths and, I've lost the count. My thoughts are going. I've noted the thoughts. I'm not going to judge. I'm going to go back, count my breaths. It's kind of relaxed. It's sort of casual. I'd sit for a timer, whatever happened. But you talk about imagining that your Zazen practice, your meditation practice should be pretty intense. And you talk about, imagine you're walking a tightrope across the Grand Canyon. Tell us about that.
We confuse energy with tension, or we confuse laziness with relaxation. Not saying that you were being lazy.
You could say it.
You know, meditation for us in the Buddhist tradition is a really urgent activity because we want to get to the bottom of our existence. What is a human being? I want to know that. And life is short. Before I die, I want to know that. So we have a sense of urgency, right? But, someone who's not interested in that approach, but just like to benefit from meditation practice, throw yourself into it, man. You know, sprinters are relaxed. Marathon runners are relaxed. But they're also pouring out their whole energy, giving themselves everything they've got to that activity. And that's where the freedom comes from in the midst of those activities, as well as the success. So meditation is that way, too. We should be completely relaxed in mind and body, but uncompromisingly doing it and being honest with ourselves when we're really throwing ourselves into it. The process of becoming one with that I mentioned requires us to give all of ourself to our situation, to our environment, to our relationship, to our work. Throw yourself into it with all you got and stay relaxed. It's kind of simple, but it's hard. It's hard because people start to use a lot of energy and it becomes tension. So the process becomes how to balance those two threads, deep relaxation and calmness, and really using the fire of your life to accomplish that activity.
Fantastic. I want to mention again for those who are interested in Zen Buddhism or already you're meditating and want to get Mato's insights, his first book, The Rinzai Zen Way, A Guide to Practice. Your latest book is called Hidden Zen, Practices for Sudden Awakening and Embodied Realization. Hidden Zen. My friend Mato, aren't you afraid that the secret order of Zen ninjas are going to come and get you for revealing all these secrets?
No, because they're me. I'm the head of the secret order of Zen ninjas. You know, and I wrote in the book, hidden doesn't mean secret, really. It's not that these things are sealed as secret, but hidden because I think a lot of Zen people especially don't realize or haven't learned a lot of these techniques, which the book talks about. So for whatever reason, my own Zen lineage has a wealth of those kinds of tools, which have traditionally only been passed between teacher and student orally. So in that sense, they're hidden. So I very inappropriately wrote them down in a book and shared them with everyone, for better or worse. I hope they're useful for people.
Now, I thought, I certainly was interested in the book because you're my friend, and I was curious about what you wrote, wanted to support you and all that. And then I immediately found the book was much more accessible, even to a real non-practitioner like me. I mean, and I'm wondering, so one of the practices, just as an example of these, many of these are very accessible. So like seeing a tree practice. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit earlier about vision or the eyes. We have a habit in the modern world of using the eyes primarily in a focused way. like I'm staring at the screen, looking at your image right now. But our ancestors used the eyes more often in a broad, sort of sweeping manner, activating the peripheral field. So the book teaches exercises to learn that, or to relearn that way of seeing if someone has lost that way of using the eyes. And when you can use the eyes that way, when you look at something like a tree, you experience it differently. You're not looking from branch to branch or leaf to leaf, dissecting the tree into pieces and experiencing kind of an arising of conceptual thought. Oh, look at that leaf. That leaf's red. That one's green. You know, we start to split things into pieces and think about them. But when you use the eyes differently, the brain activity calms and you start to experience the tree kind of in its totality or wholeness as a living thing. And you can see there's a certain movement to it. Your relationship with it feels different. Again, there's a feeling of becoming one with or connecting to this thing I call tree, rather than putting it on the chopping block and cutting it into pieces the way we often do. Yeah, so it's magical. You know, I think I wrote in the book that when we're kids, we remember this experience. The world was just magical and alive because we used our senses differently. We used our bodies differently then. And we also weren't spinning in our heads as much as we are now. We breathed differently. Everything was different when we were kids. We lose some of that stuff. I think some of these exercises can help people to regain that experience, you know, looking at a tree. Wow, that's alive. That thing is magical. We don't need mushrooms or anything for that. You know, you can experience the world in its magical sort of livingness. What a nice thing to regain that, especially, you know, like this past year, as you mentioned, very difficult for people. A lot of us feel like we're sort of in the modern wasteland right now, cut off from everything. Mm-hmm. But we don't have to be that way. We can re-enter sort of a magical world, which is more real, more true than the one we inhabit just in our heads. That's what that kind of exercise is for.
I want to read something briefly from your first book as we're coming to the end of our time today. We could go deep on this, and maybe we'll be able to chat again and go even deeper. You write, this is chapter 6 from the Rinzai Way. At the core of the suffering we experience and at the root of our angst and confusion is a deep-rooted habit of experiencing things in dualistic manner. Each of us orders our experience through a self-created division of the world into I and not I, that is subject and object, self and other. And a little bit further down, you say, sometimes succeeding, sometimes failing in what becomes a lifelong game of gain and loss. We rarely transcend our habitual self-absorbed way of seeing, marked by bifurcation, conflict, division, and a profound sense of incompleteness. I hope our listeners can listen to that and feel inside if that resonates or not. And I think if anything we touched on made folks curious, for our listeners, if you heard that passage and it's like there is something more, or there is a different way, or I don't have to be as anxious as I am on most days, I hope you'll get curious. I hope you'll check out The Rinzai Zen Way, A Guide to Practice. Mado, your second book, Hidden Zen. I hope people visit korinji.org. That's korinji.org. We'll, of course, put those links up. And if you want to support Mado more, if you want to support Korinji, if you want to get, I find these fascinating, kind of like behind the scenes videos of what things are for and like and used in a monastery. Visit patreon.com/Korinji, KORINJI. And for a very modest contribution each month, you get this insider view. I think this is a fantastic set of resources for times like these. So Mado, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Such a pleasure, Kevin. Good to see you.